February 11th, 1990, Tokyo, Japan. The official poster captured the feeling of the fight. The focal point of the artwork is the large upper body of Iron Mike Tyson, which stands in contrast to the smaller image of James Buster Douglas, who is relegated to the corner. The headline reads, "Tyson is back." This fight was a tune-up match for Iron Mike Tyson on his way to defending his championship against Evander Holyfield. One of the announcers said it was, quote, "just another day of work for Mike Tyson," end quote, and commented how Tyson looked bored entering the arena that night. Fast forward 8 rounds into this heavyweight fight. Taking the indomitable Tyson past the 5th round was an accomplishment all by itself. But then the seemingly inevitable happened. With a single blow, a right-handed uppercut, Tyson showed why he was the greatest boxer in the game and why the odds were 42-1 in his favor. It seemed like during the previous 7 rounds, he was merely playing with his prey to amuse himself before delivering that fatal blow. The 5'10", 210-pound Tyson dropped Buster Douglas. On count 7, the embattled Douglas staggers upward, and on count 9, the audience at the Tokyo Dome witnessed a resurrection like Lazarus walking out of his grave. Still, as that 8th round ended, the announcers practically handed the belt to Tyson right then and there, while giving Douglas the mere comment, "No matter what happens, we give a lot of credit to Buster Douglas for making this a fight." You don't need credit when you rise from the dead. Round 10, and Buster Douglas further defies the laws of human nature, that is, the laws of the baddest man on the planet who had ruled the world of boxing for the previous 3 years. The shocked announcers kept repeating, "Look at this!" They could only look, but they refused to believe it, as Buster's fist pummeled Iron Mike. For the first time in his professional career, the king of boxing was not just dethroned, he was clean knocked out. The fight poster proved prophetic. Tyson was not only back, he was on his back. You are listening to On Further Review.
On Further Review is a conversation that uncovers the fascinating details of the most remarkable sporting events. Events you grew up watching, and maybe a couple you've never heard of before.
Join our discussion of upsets, dynasties, and how one event can be the difference between being a footnote and being a legend. This is On Further Review.
Yeah, so Buster Douglas.
Who is this guy?
What a guy. I don't follow boxing that much.
Same.
But I had never even heard of this guy before. I knew that there was something with Mike Tyson losing, right? And that's kind of what I'd heard about, yeah, that Mike Tyson lost a fight. I didn't know who he lost to. Right. Just knew that he lost a fight. So really interesting to go kind of into this history of who James Buster Douglas was.
Right.
Columbus guy, and you know, myself living in that city for a couple of years too, and you know,
yep,
can,
yep,
you know,
a nod,
kind of know what that city is all about there. The you can see that lineage, especially where he grew up too. I think what they say, east side, I think they said, right? Was it west, okay, or east?
I think it was the east side.
That was east side.
Could be wrong.
Yeah.
Fact check it.
Yeah. Double check that. Let's see your references, right? Yeah. And what did he say? His dad was, the first Golden Glove?
Yeah.
Golden Glove champion. Glove.
Yep. Yeah. From Ohio.
From Columbus, yep, in the 60s. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, which is pretty cool accomplishment. Pretty athletic too, growing up as well too. It seems like, you know, playing football and basketball throughout high school. But yeah, then he seemed like he really kind of turned focus to boxing, you know, just, yeah, kind of really put that effort into boxing, which to me is surprising, especially when you're playing football in Columbus, Ohio, you're thinking one,
right,
thing. You're thinking, right, going to play the shoe, right?
Right. So exactly.
And to, you know, Columbus is a football town. It's a college football town. So if you're playing football and if you're playing high school football, you're thinking of putting on that scarlet and gray. You're thinking about,
yeah,
or something, right? So it's interesting, yeah, that he decided to go. You know, he was playing football. He's a big guy too. Like, this kid's a big dude.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he athletic, very athletic. Right. So he could have he might have been able to make a maybe not Ohio State, but could have made a, you know, a football roster at some university if he wanted to, but instead he turns pro.
Yeah.
So yeah, go ahead.
I was listening to another podcast or just interviews. I was looking for interviews, YouTube and what have you, just, you know, Apple Store search, you know, Buster Douglas, because I'm trying to figure out, you know, who this guy was as well. I knew a little bit about him. Like you said, the narrative's always been, he's the guy that beat Mike the one time, you know, like he's the guy that dethroned this guy that was on this upward trajectory. And one of the things he says about like his early kind of athletic ability was he seriously considered, according to Douglas himself, going to, it would have been more like a D3 or a D2, but playing basketball. Like he really enjoyed playing basketball and stuff. Mm-hmm. And from
could you imagine a 6'4", 231 pound center in basketball?
Man. Oh,
or
man.
Like four, like dude, like, or four, whatever, you know.
Right, just ready to go, especially like 1990 with, you know, his athleticism and stuff. I feel like he could have done something there. But but from his own recollection, you know, a huge part of it was the security of knowing, like, his dad had a gym set up. His dad had this boxing history and lineage, really. But it is you're right, a kind of an interesting choice to take that on, you know, to go kind of follow in his father's footsteps, as it were, literally working out with his dad, literally joining his gym and
kind
of setting on this path instead.
I wonder too, I didn't look this up. I wonder how many other heavyweight championships got started because of their dad teaching them. I would imagine that Buster might have been the minority of that. In terms of like having, a lot of these guys grew up in really rough situations and really difficult, you know, especially a guy like Mike Tyson, right? So he had a rough upbringing. And so it's just interesting to see Buster Douglas take a lot of the opportunities that he was given to him. I'm not saying, and obviously living in Columbus in, you know, the time he grew up in too, wouldn't have been an easy feat for any black guy either, you know, especially systemic racism that they're now. I can't imagine what it would been like, you know, 40,
even
50 30
years
ago.
Or beyond when he was growing up, for sure.
Exactly. But for him to take kind of his dad's vision, his dad, what his dad did, and really kind of take it to the next level, I think is – I wonder if he's one of the few people actually able to do that in the world of boxing. It's just – it's interesting, interesting thing there. So what did you – kind of walk me through your thoughts then. So he goes pro, right?
Yeah.
He goes pro at the, I think the age 21, I think is what I read.
Yeah.
He goes pro. What fights leading up to the Tyson fight did you kind of have your eye on? Because you kind of worked up the ranks. Which fights kind of intrigued you the most as you read Buster Douglas' story?
Yeah. So for me, I mean, there's some that come up as you just kind of do a general search of some of his fights leading up. He actually had a fair amount of success kind of climbing up the ladder, as it were, from turning pro. Had the Junior Olympics that I think he wound up fighting in. I know there was some other, you know, fights kind of up and coming. The one that struck to me, and it's fast forwarding a little bit, so I think I'm trying to remember overall what he was. So leading, like, this is up to Tyson, but kind of the background before it, and that's he was 28-4-1 before Tyson. So him, he established a reputation of winning with just a couple losses and an undecided outcome as well. The one that really stood out to me was a 1987 fight that I kind of read about between him and Tucker. And that was actually the undercard for Tyson, and I think his name was Jonathan Thomas or something like that, was the main event on that one. So that was like the first one that he struck. He was actually number two in the IBF belt. And I think the guy's name was James Tucker. Tucker was kind of the number one, considered the number one. And it's interesting because, A, you start having that symmetry of Douglas Tyson well before 1990 and a couple years before it. But also the winner of that match was going to go on and fight Tyson. So he fights against Tucker, and it goes into about the 10th round. And from what I could find, clips and trying to see like the fight itself, he kind of worked him. He kind of worked Douglas did for the first about four or five, and then just kind of started fading a little bit. And
was that the one I was reading some things and watching some podcasts where it seemed like Douglas kind of, or Buster kind of just felt like he lost his gas, kind of speak, and kind of like didn't have enough stamina to keep going.
So in the 10th round of that fight, it gets called, and I saw the clips from the fight, you know, again, what's available, and he's not putting his hands up. He's not throwing anything. So the ref actually steps in and calls it for Tucker in the 10th. He had stopped throwing punches. Douglas, that is. Wow. And so I think there was stuff going from what I read, stuff going on off, you know, out of the ring between him and his dad, and trying to figure out, you know, some different fighting styles.
Was this around the same time that he brought in John Johnson as a manager, or is this?
Yep. So this, according to an interview I heard from Douglas, he said that this loss to Tucker, he actually sees as setting, like, turning a new page for him. So he winds up going, and he winds up leaving his dad's gym. He talks about, you can find an interview where he talks about he brought his mom to the dinner table.
So that
he could confront his dad.
Oh, man. Could you imagine having a dad be, as you know, your dad is the Golden Glove winner who could just take you out back and beat the ever out of you, you know.
Right.
Like, damn, dude. Like, it's, you know, I think of that one too. He said that his mom was there for protection. Like, his mom was there to make sure that his dad didn't go off on him.
Because,
I mean, it seemed like his, from what I read, his dad wasn't violent towards him at all.
No.
He just had he knew what Buster could do. He just knew what he could do and wanted the best for him.
Yep.
So, yeah. And obviously, being that, you know, a Golden Glove winner of your own right, you're not, you know, you think you can, you think you can train your son too. You think you know him, and he did a great job up until that point too.
Right.
So the Tucker fight was the one that preceded John Johnson,
right?
And so, and his team of guys, right?
Right.
Because he like Buster had other guys too. He had another trainer as well too.
Yep.
He had a some kind of spiritual advisor too to kind of help him with like belief in himself and things like that too, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said he had. I think he brought in John Johnson then after that Tucker loss.
And then.
I think he mentioned two other trainers, one specifically for like his spiritual mental well-being, the other one more for the fitness side, and then John Johnson for the actual technicality. So John Johnson, talk about the Ohio State University, was actually a coach under Woody Hayes. And,
oh, wow.
I don't know to what role or what extent, but any interview you see him talking about this fight years after the fact. John Johnson's got his Ohio State gear on, or his zip off, you know.
I've heard different things about Johnson too, in terms of how intense that guy was, and how just absolutely ruthless and intense, you know, and just demanding the absolute best from his boxers, and expecting that of Douglas too. You know, just he was.
Yeah.
From what I've read, you know, people are saying he could have his own, you know, his own story too, but just because of how unique and he said what he thought. And and even times too, reading something or listening to something where Douglas mentioned how Johnson would just get in his face, but it was a mutual respect. Like they understood, they understood where they stood with each other. And he understood that once chairs started to be thrown, then, you know, he means what he's saying.
Right, right. And just the intensity required for that, to be at that level for that sport. I mean, you kind of need somebody that's a bit unhinged.
Because you're fighting someone.
Right.
Yeah, if you can't take somebody in your face there, then how do you take somebody in your face when it's, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So, it's interesting. So Douglas changed managers in 89, you said? Was that?
87.
87. Okay. 87. And 87 is kind of the year that I think Mike Tyson won his first title, heavyweight title, 87, right?
Yep.
Where
yep.
his first of three undefeated titles.
Yep.
Right? So 87, after 87, do you have any thoughts of who Douglas fought after that Tucker fight? Or because you lost that fight and then
So then he goes on. All I know is I don't remember the specific opponents, but obviously it puts him at a setback. Tucker beats him and then winds up going on and fighting Tyson. And I think that one,
and Tyson won. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that one lasted less than five rounds, you know, the typical lore that started for Iron Mike.
Cause Tyson hadn't gone past five rounds since 87 or since the 85 or 87. Like he had this string of fights, not only winning but three consecutive years, but a fight didn't go past round five since 87. Right. A phenomenal accomplishment in his own right there.
And that's what I think lends to what Tyson became. I mean, as far as how he's perceived, how he's viewed, even leads in well before this, establishing that kind of lopsided nature of people he would go up against, where they wouldn't even last five rounds. I mean, you just throw on Mike Tyson knockouts, and these are just ferocious uppercuts that drop grown men time and time again. And it adds. So while Douglas is in the middle of turning things around and kind of repositioning, looking at it a new way, Tyson's just racking them up. He's blowing through not even close, blowing through competition, establishing himself as this almost larger than life persona and boxer, you know, that he was.
Yeah. Everybody knew what Mike Tyson was all about. And I was listening to a clip from the Joe Rogan podcast, and he mentioned that it seemed like with Buster Douglas, he was one of those guys that you knew he was talented, but he just never put it together. He never put it, you know, you had the Tucker fight where he kind of fell out. He just never put it together. And so, like, you knew this guy was talented, but you just didn't, you know, he never had enough to kind of pull the pieces together.
Right, or go quite over that edge against the stellar competition, you know.
Yeah, that's you know, let's be honest too. Even, you know, Tyson was head and shoulders above his competition in his day.
Right.
Like, right. But even just going past, you know, past what was perceived as kind of that second tier of, you know, the Evander Holyfields, the Foreman, the guys like that, right? So they had him kind of on that third tier level.
Right.
So let's get into the kind of the pre-fight then, right? So so Buster Douglas has kind of worked his way up. He lost to Tucker, but he kind of worked his way back up. I think he beat Trevor Burbick, I think, in 89. I think that was actually a fight where I was thinking the one you mentioned before, Tucker. So he won unanimous decision. Buster won in 89, which I think kind of set him up for the fight with Tyson.
Right.
So Tyson's people reach out to Buster's. What did you hear about how they, you know, it didn't seem like it was a – Tyson didn't view this as a heavyweight fight, did he?
No.
Like what was his
– No, like, I think the great Don King had a reference for it in the sense of he said he was calling it a fluffer fight. So then we have them reaching out to, you know, Tyson's people rather reaching out to Douglas's people to kind of arrange this fight. And not necessarily in the most respectful of ways. I definitely don't think it was viewed as anything other than a tune-up, really.
Yeah. What do you mean by not respectful? Is there anything that you saw as far as their comments that they made to, like, in their imitation, or was it just the fact that they, like, you know?
I mean, there's a couple different quotes. I don't remember who it came from, but a couple of different people from Tyson's group. I think I don't want to put it on John King. He's got probably enough going on from historical referencing. But somebody there referred to it as a fluffer fight. Someone referred to it as something they've got to do. Those are the comments that I saw as far as
Interesting about Don King too, because if I remember correctly, Don King promoted both Douglas and Tyson on this fight.
He did. I mean,
which is kind of interesting, you know.
Yeah, Douglas has been interviewed about it 30 years after the fact and said, I mean, kind of.
but in the world of boxing, especially the WC and the WBA, if you want to get on, if you want to be on the in the octagon, you got to go through Don King. Right. And there almost is no other way to get on it.
Right.
Without, if you,
right.
Especially
like
in the U.S., If you're a U.S. fighter, if you're a U.S. fighter, you're going through Don King. That's just kind of the way it is in boxing, especially in the WC and the WBA.
Right.
You know, it's just.
And I mean, to me, it's, you know, Tyson was the meal ticket for boxing, for American boxing. Tyson was the guy. So I understand perhaps the frustration of feeling like, wait, this guy's in both of our corners, even though he's basically been in Tyson's corner for the last 5 years.
Sure.
But there's an aspect where, like, I think even Douglas realized, I mean, I know he realized that Tyson was the meal ticket because that's what he wanted the shot at. He wanted the shot at being able to be called the champ, you know, and to do that, we all know that. I mean, you talk about that in playoffs and stuff like for football or hockey or any of the things, you know, you got to run through the number one seeds. You have to run through the big dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. And that no one was bigger than the baddest man on the planet when it came to boxing. Like he was.
Right.
So he's the baddest guy on the planet, right? You have Mike Tyson. Everybody wants to get a piece of Mike Tyson. Why did nobody want to host a fight?
Well, I think because nobody thought anybody was going to watch it. Nobody thought anybody was going to be interested.
Was Mike that good that his, like, because you see great people, right? So if September, October, I was in Vegas for a conference and, you have all the different Vegas shows. And so the Vegas show that I went to see was the Vegas Golden Knights as it took on the Chicago Blackhawks, right? My thinking was, I'm not a Blackhawks fan, but what else am I going to see, you know, Jonathan Toews and these great hockey players, right? I want to see him in person at least once in my life. So wouldn't that still apply? Like you see like you're in Boston, Tom Brady, right? So you have, you know, these phenomenal players that we know are the greatest of all times.
Yep.
Was Mike just that good where people got bored of how good he was?
I think he was. I think some of it
was it because they're like, I'm not gonna pay you this much money for a 30 second fight kind of thing.
I go through that. I go through that with UFC, shout out ESPN Plus. It takes me a little bit to wanna buy all those to buy that pay per view, you know, for a fight. It kind of reminds me a little bit. You remember what was it? Maybe 10 years ago now. I don't remember when she was fighting, but Ronda Rousey when she was fighting, when she was at the peak, and it was like no one was lasting longer than, I mean, she was keeping it under a minute. She was in and out and socks probably weren't sweated through yet. You know, she was just, she was ready to go. Well, they don't wear socks in UFC, but
you know what
I'm saying? Like she was barely breaking a sweat dropping people. And there was a huge aspect where people were like, you know, why do I want to pay for something? You know, unless she was fighting someone big, right? Unless she was fighting someone that you could see being a rival, you know, I think there was an apprehension of like, do I want to spend the money? So that's what it made me think of. Regardless,
were they saving up for the Tyson Holyfield fight then?
I think they were. Tyson was vocal about wanting Holyfield, and this was his tune up game. So I mean, there's the other things that point to nobody wanted this fight is the famous, now infamous 42-1. There was one Vegas sports book that
and
even
it was
made by
the Mirage put it on there just kind of it seemed like kind of a joke.
Yeah. And
it
I
was
read,
kind of just like a hey, a dare.
right? And yeah. I definitely venture into the waters of the degenerate sports gambling quite a bit. Sure. So I was very intrigued at like how 42-1 got set. So like it started at 27-1 and no one put money on Douglas. So it went way up to 4. Wow. So the reason it landed at 42-1 is because that was the first mark. They kept growing it. That was the first mark where they started getting some money on Douglas.
Wow. Wow. Yeah.
So there is a bet, and this will go maybe more into the actual, you know, aftermath or what have you, but there was a bet that somebody placed for $168,000 on Tyson to beat Douglas, and they would have cashed out only $4,000.
Oh my word.
Just to win. And instead they lose the 168, as we know, you know, not to spoiler alert, but
yeah, no. And it's interesting. Like I didn't look through this up. I guess there's some videos out there too. If you want to go look at it, you can go look at it. There was a couple of guys, I guess, who bet on Buster and yeah. they were like, hey, I bet on Buster.
Right.
I mean, at that odds, you're dumb not to throw right. a, you know,
but they only had
quick $50 in that thing and you're gonna right.
So the largest bets they took for Douglas, according to the guy at Mirage, that was retelling the account, was $1,000. No one. There were 10 different grand bets for Douglas. Aside from that, it was all lower. Aside from that, it was degenerates like myself that are sitting there maybe a little drunk on a Saturday night going, I'll put $10 on this guy. Exactly. Let's see what happens, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, as we talk about like sports history and sporting events, you know, maybe it's more the upsets or the shocking things. I often joke about how those things like this fight, things of the unusual nature in sports are what keep me incredibly optimistic when I shouldn't be. So like, that's what happens. If we didn't have a 42-1, probably wouldn't care about throwing something on an underdog fighter. But back to this, you know, it just shows, while I don't know that there was overt disrespect for Douglas as a fighter, there was definitely the feeling from, I think, Tyson. I think anybody's camp besides Douglas, and maybe even him himself, as far as this being incredibly lopsided.
Yeah, yeah. So 42-1 odds going into this fight.
Here comes the degenerate out in me.
Okay.
So I wanted to figure out 42-1. It's a number. It sounds crazy. If you don't bet, you know, you might think like, oh, you know, like try to do the math in your head type of thing. Let me paint some word pictures for you. The Browns to win the Super Bowl this coming year, a season that we're not sure about right now with COVID-19. They are 40-1 to win the Super
Bowl. Okay.
The Heat to win the NBA in the restart are 40-1 to win the NBA Finals. Your beloved Nashville Predators are 40-1 to take
there
home Lord Stanley's Cup in this rerun. And we just saw what happened to them down where you reside.
Hey, we got three goals.
These are my two favorites, though. UMBC at the time when they knocked off the number one overall ranked Virginia Cavaliers were only 25-1 to win that game. And then here's one that's even better. For the 2020 election, not to get political, Hillary Clinton to win this election, one she's not even running in, is at 50-1.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So that shows you two things. One,
that gives you perspective.
My depravity. And two, just kind of gives you, like, perspective. So we're talking about, you know, 8 odds to 1 different than betting on someone that's not even in the presidential election to win. Like the 42-1 is just, it's incredible.
Like, yeah, there's like, if you're 10-1 odds, you're guaranteed to win. What if it's 25-1, it's just, it's, you know,
right.
You're betting on the point line at that point, right? You're
betting. Yeah, you're trying to find some other way, or you're wrapping it into something else, and yeah.
Yeah, you're betting on the over/under. You're betting something different, right? But if you get 42-1, like it's not
right.
Not
even, I mean,
close.
I'll be honest. If I was looking at a 42-1, you know, bet slip for a boxing match, I'd start looking. This is where you find value as a degenerate gambler. You start looking for which round will he knock him out in, because that actually gives you some money back versus, you know, cents on the dollar. Not even that, but it's incredible. And that's the thing to me of studying this, kind of bigger, you know, bird's eye view. I kind of looked at this, and we can talk about it, you know, a little later as far as, was this a one hit wonder? But all these things, the 42-1, the fact that no one in, you know, no one besides Tokyo took this fight, kind of led it in my mind to believe, I mean, that Douglas was kind of, you know, a bum. But it was mostly just compared to Tyson. This is a man that actually worked himself through the IBF and some of those series as far as his fights. He won 6 in a row leading up to Tyson. But comparatively, so it's just a gap that they had. This isn't someone that was off the street. I think Douglas had the comment looking back on it where he said, you know, Don King wasn't driving down the street, saw me walking and said, hey, you want to fight Tyson? He earned his spot. And even though, again, we can debate whether it's a one hit wonder or not, but like, regardless of if he was or not, he definitely earned his right to be there. Albeit you kind of had to be invited to Tyson's room. So
he was invited to Tyson's room, 42-1 odds. Let's talk his strategy going into this fight, right? So
go for it. Yeah.
From what I read and what I kind of watched, listened to Buster's interviews, he trained like a demon. He trained like a straight demon. He just trained. Like he mentioned running in Columbus in the wintertime when the snow on the ground, you know, just kind of always out there every single morning, no matter what. The city would be closed down because of snow, and he would be out there running.
He'd be going.
Just training. And the strategy from what he mentioned was this. He said the idea was don't go straight back. Stay busy and let your hands go. Yeah. Right?
Let them hands fly.
Yeah, let them hands fly. Exactly. Let them hands go. You know, the idea was a punch. Yeah. And he did. Through the first 7 rounds of the fight, Buster took it to Tyson.
He really did.
And that was a strategy too. The idea was the work you do in the early fight shows up in the later rounds.
Right.
And so I think it was Tyson's left eye. The HBO commentators said that was the most punishment they'd ever seen Tyson absorb. Yeah. That was in the seventh, I think.
He hit him in the seventh and opened it up a little bit.
Yeah. So he was trying to you know, establish a foundation of just staying busy, let them hands go, and staying consistent, which is an interesting strategy, especially because it almost seems like Buster's strategy was to take him to decision.
In a way, right?
Which is interesting, especially given the Tucker fight, where he lost his gas in the Tucker fight.
Right.
But I wonder if it's because Tyson had never gone past the 5th round. Sure. If the thought was, hey, look,
get him past.
I'm more, you know, athletically, I can outlast Tyson. I can outlast this guy. I can, you know, as long as I don't get dropped in one single blow, if I can keep the hands busy, he can't hit me with that uppercut because he's constantly having to defend.
Yeah.
And then if I do that, we can outlast him, then we can get to a decision. It almost seemed like Buster's strategy was getting to a decision or getting to the later rounds and seeing
the later rounds for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Make him work for it.
Exactly. Which is a huge contrast to Tyson's strategy,
which
was basically the same strategy he's had his entire professional career. And that is, you know, right uppercut right there.
Because it worked.
The guy.
It was working. He definitely, I tried to get as much footage as I could of the fight, either through documentaries or what have you. And you're 100% right as far as my takeaway was the same. The first 7, he was working them. It's interesting to see. I think it was on a documentary or something. I know there's a few out there, but Douglas said that, you know, early going in the rounds, like some of the communication between him and Johnson in the corner, you know, he was working them, but they were both, and it might've been Johnson more so, they were both concerned that if it went to decision, that they just wouldn't give it to him. Even though he had worked them, he had to be consistent. So the 7th round comes up and he's starting to hit him. Tyson's definitely just going for home runs. I mean, the entire first four rounds for sure. Tyson's like absorb, swing.
Yeah. And that really was his strategy all along too.
Right.
Was he just, and a lot of times too, just the presence of Iron Mike put fear in people's, in their hearts.
That was the thing that was interesting too. I think somebody that might, one of the play-by-play or whatever they might call them, the announcers, said in retrospect on a documentary I'd listened to, he said, in those first 3 to 4 rounds, you realize something that had not been done before for Tyson. And it was, yes, he was getting worked and taking on hits. But the second thing was, this person wasn't afraid of him. Like, from the opening bell, Douglas started going after Tyson. And everybody else had tried to outlast Tyson by avoiding him. And Douglas definitely tried to outlast him by keeping him busy. And I think Johnson was the one that gave him the advice of, like, work him on one side. And then when he turns, then you start directing him again. And what he basically was doing was moving Tyson's feet left and right and left and right to cover each of the barrage, and then you could work him into a corner and try to get away with some blows, like in the early seventh when he caught him on the eye.
Yeah. So interesting strategy for Douglas compared to Tyson's kind of just uppercut thing.
Yeah.
Tyson had a rough go of things, not only in terms of just not expecting that. I read that I've never watched any of Douglas's fight leading up into which is, I talk about disrespectful too, right? Like, you're not even watch this guy, you just go in and just take him out, right?
Yeah.
So, he had some while Buster is training like a demon, Tyson's kind of living large and enjoying being the champ, right?
Yep,
he's had some inner turmoil. He's had some inner turmoil himself too. I think he broke up with his 1 year wife of that at the time. He lost his manager, I think Kevin Rooney. There's reports of him being knocked down in training.
Yeah,
And from what I read, he was into, when you're the heavyweight champion, he was living like the heavyweight champion.
Into
all kinds of, girls, drugs, everything else, right?
There's a reason that role I can blank it on it, the Ed Helms, the Hangover movie. There's a reason that came so natural to Tyson. He was like, I call this 1988.
But
no, in all seriousness, you're right. Yeah.
So not only does that happen, his inner, that kind of thing. And Tyson says that he was focused for the fight. Reading, like watching interviews and watching stuff afterwards, like he never once blamed those things as far as his lack of preparation. He said I was prepared for the fight,
right?
Or even stuff like his equipment stuff, right? So he didn't have a what is it called? It's like an ice pack, basically. Instead, he was like, there was like a rubber glove filled with ice water. So
I saw an interview with his manager at the time, whoever it was, that wound up replacing the guy he had, and he goes, "Yeah, that was on me."
He's like,
"I didn't bring it."
Well, no shit, man. Like, I guess.
Right.
So, I read this quote from legendary boxing commentator Teddy Atlas. He said, "Dumb mediocrity gathered in Tyson's corner." Couldn't even train a fish to swim.
Yeah.
So you have a guy who is over-prepared with Douglas, and he has a strategy. He has an idea to win. He knows how to do it. And then you have a guy in Tyson who didn't train as hard, kind of took it for granted. They didn't view this as very big. Again, this is a tune-up fight for the Holyfield fight, right?
Right. What Tyson's eyes are on. Absolutely.
Tyson wants to beat Holyfield. Not to give spoiler alert, but he wanted a bite of Holyfield, right? So he wanted, he wanted to take him out.
Quite literally, though.
Quite literally, yeah. So he didn't train at all, and then this led to what I consider, I think it might be the greatest upset in sports history. Definitely the greatest upset in boxing history.
Definitely in boxing, for sure.
But definitely in boxing. but it's at least in the conversation of the greatest upsets in sports.
It's gotta be top, we'll say top 10, inarguably.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. Because first off, no challenger had taken Tyson past round 5.
Right.
No one had.
The dominance previous, yeah.
Yeah. And then Buster gets knocked down in the 8th round. And it, watching his comments too, like it seemed Buster kind of took his eye off the ball, so to speak. He took his eye off, right?
A little bit.
He started to think, like, you know, what do you think of me now? Like,
Douglas claims that the start, people have asked him, when did you know you would beat Tyson? And he claims it's the start of the 8th round. He said, yeah, and quote, I'm about to beat his ass.
Yeah.
In his corner. Yeah. And so he gets, yeah, it's so interesting to me that, like, that's when he put it together and he said, this is my night. I've got him. And then, yeah, he, and then that's the, just enough of a relaxation where Tyson catches him early in the 8th.
Yeah. Yeah. And he, in an interview too, I was watching this interview by a guy, and Buster said the first thing his dad said walking when he got home wasn't, you know, congratulations. It was, you know, you got cocky in the 8th round, didn't you?
Right. Yeah. Right. That's the dad. That's the dad I was pressing.
Exactly.
That's good stuff.
Exactly. That's why he was the Golden Glove winner there.
That's
so
right.
he gets knocked down the 8th round. So you watched this. You went back and watched this fight, right? So
yeah,
you watched this.
Yep.
What was your opinion of the 8th and 9th rounds? What did you see there?
So I'll preface it with this. I heard Douglas say that he thought he felt confident he had won it in the 8th before rewatching. So that's
okay.
Obviously in my mind when I'm getting to the 7th round and he opens his eye, you know, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The 8th round starts. Douglas hits the mat. According to Don King, the longest 8 seconds in the world. Maybe a little bit of like God Moses stopping the sun type of thing. And some people's opinion. But
yeah,
you get into the 8th round and he knocks him down. And it's not overstated to say his resurrection from the mat. When you watch it in real time, that connects. And it's one that it's an uppercut that Tyson has thrown multiple times before in between getting worked by Douglas. Only this one lands and you see elation on Tyson's face, maybe more relief of just like, finally,
yeah,
this MF-er is over. Like this, I'm about to finish this up and go get ready for Holyfield. I think people thought he was down. Like even the announcers, one of my favorite things about rewatching the thing is to listen to the announcers. I don't know how many times they said with the most surprise they could muster in their voice, wow, this is exciting, like in that tone, a surprise. They were surprised that it was exciting. And then he hits him in the 7th round and the emotions in the broadcast are truly felt where people are like, he's not just messing around with Tyson, he caught him a little bit. And then the 8th round opens up and people are thinking, is this the end of the champ as we've known him?
Mm-hmm.
And then he lands this blow on Douglas and it's like, it's almost like the arena goes, oh, that's right.
Oh, okay, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like watching the 1 vs. 16 team in the NCAA tournament,
right,
where like that first half they take it close. You're like, oh man, these guys are taking it close.
Yep.
And then the second half comes out, and you know they just, you know, last, like, oh, okay, that's right. That's why they're the number one seed.
Exactly.
You know, and that's kind of what, you know, that's what that 8th round felt like, was okay, now we know why.
Yeah.
Now we know why he's the best.
But from the moment Douglas gets back off the mat and regains his footing, I think for the duration of the 8th round, if my recollection is correct from rewatching it, he kind of just outlasts Tyson, but he doesn't shy away from him in the bottom of the 8th.
That 8th round ended seconds after Douglas was knocked down.
Gotcha.
Right.
Yep. Okay.
So he was knocked down, and after that, the eighth round was over.
So when the bell rings to start it up to the 9th, the announcers make a point of Douglas kind of comes out of his corner like a bat out of hell back at him, and that was so surprising for them. I think because of kind of hearkening back to the Tucker fight, of where Douglas was kind of known from some people as far as someone that quit, like someone that, you know, when it got too long, when it got too rough. And I think people, like, he wasn't the guy that people expected to take that punch from Tyson and come back. Sure, we could understand the first couple of rounds where he jumped on him early. Tyson's looking ahead to Holyfield, whatever.
Yeah. But
he hits that mat. People really thought it was a wrap just because they thought he wasn't going to have the stamina to try to come back. But that's definitely what he does in the start of the ninth. He comes right back where he left off in the seventh.
Yeah, man. So he comes back in the ninth, just take things over again. And everybody, from what I understand, Douglas won the ninth round.
Right.
Douglas won the ninth round. And then the 10th round, watching that part of the fight there,
yeah,
he took him out. Took him down. And it wasn't even close.
And you can see the start of the 10th round, there's a whole new feeling. So we had the seventh where it's like, oh, he's not just working him, he got him. Then the eighth is definitely Tyson's reply of trying to come back at him. And then the ninth, you know, he kind of reestablishes himself, Douglas, that is, like getting back into it, getting right back to where he was at the start. But the 10th, he comes out and there's just like, again, I can only rewatch with history in the past, so I know the result. But as I rewatch it in the 10th, there's just this finality of this is something that's going to be over soon, of Douglas coming out.
It almost seemed too, watching those clips of that 10th round, it almost seems too that Tyson gave up.
It does feel like he was probably like shocked.
He put his hands down and he kind of, he knew what was about to happen and he had nothing like,
right.
It seemed like Tyson's gas let up.
Right.
In that round. I think it's interesting. Just interesting comparison.
The thing about boxing to me, if I were to get in the ring, and I'd be one of the worst boxers ever, T-Rex arms, and I'm fairly passive, so I don't know how well I'd be aggressive. But I try to put myself in that situation. There's got to be, in every single fight, there's got to be a moment when someone knows they're beat. And I can't imagine the feeling of walking back out on a 10th round, Mike Tyson, king of the world, and you know you're beat.
Yeah.
Like there's that feeling. Both Douglas knows you're beat and you know you're beat. And you kind of have to go out there and take it to end.
Man.
And then all that it meant for potentially for Tyson in losing. I mean, all that quadrupled on top of just getting your bell rung and lights out for you. So,
yeah. So the post-fight controversy, leave it to Don King to have a controversy, right? So,
right. It's so interesting to see too. Like because I tried to watch it knowing again, there was that controversy. I tried to watch, you know, Douglas's on the mat, gets back up, versus Tyson. And there is an aspect where when you first watch Tyson get off the mat, it feels like he's up in time. It feels like it. However, his mouth guard's hanging out. He's kind of got a hand on the rope and a hand on the ref. Like, as far as I think the resetting, I definitely think that it was called correctly. And obviously, you mentioned the controversy as far as leaving it to Don King to try to stir up stuff. Douglas says that the only time he was able to enjoy that win over Mike was when they announced his name to the time he got back to the dressing room. And then all the joy went away.
So the controversy wasn't over the count of Tyson, right?
It was the
8th round knockout or the 8th round blow by Tyson.
It was the comparison between the two.
The comparison, yeah, right. So what did you find as far as what are your thoughts on that 10-second count? Is it real 10 seconds? Is it, how does?
So they were saying.
Where do you stand on the controversy? Are you, you know?
I mean, I'm sure Douglas would have been okay if they had called it and got back up and he knocks him down again. I think as far as as history proves, and maybe as some of the legality of it that ensued, I think it was pretty clear who won the fight at that point. Having rewatched it, I do think that the count seems a little quick, for Tyson.
Oh, for Tyson. So you think the controversy is in the Tyson one?
Well, I just mean, comparatively. So
Okay.
I do feel like Douglas got more time to get up than Tyson did.
Okay. Okay.
So that would be the comparison. But I know there's a difference between, I can't remember the terminology, but, you know, the people that are counting the time, the referee versus, like, an official time
stopper. Yeah, the timekeeper versus the referee. Yeah. And from what I understand, it's the referee's count that is decisive and not the timekeeper.
Right.
So it's not necessarily the timekeeper. I think in the eighth round knockout, the timekeeper was 3 seconds ahead of the referee. But
gotcha.
Douglas was watching the referee. He wasn't watching the timekeeper on the side. You're trained to watch the referee. And you're trained, you know, you're trained too that, like, you don't get up on foot count four. You kind of do a self-check of yourself.
Oh, yeah, they tell you to stay down and work your way up.
Work your way up, take a self-assessment, see how you're feeling, and see what happens. Interesting that this is not the only countdown or the count controversy in boxing. So years prior, Dempsey versus, I think, Tooney or Tunney. I'm probably butchering his name, but Dempsey, another one. Dempsey, you know, Jack Dempsey is a phenomenal boxer, right? Yeah. Legend. So they had a new rule where you had to go to your corner before the count started, and Dempsey didn't do that. And he lost 5 seconds on his count, which actually allowed Tony to kind of get up, and then Dempsey lost his title because Tony wound up beating him. Kind of the same kind of thing, different because it's, you know, Tyson wasn't in his
– But it went the other way.
Douglas's corner, but the same idea where, you know, seemingly extra seconds. And Dempsey, too, says, hey, look, you know, he didn't blame – he didn't have Don King back in the day, but he didn't blame Tony for it. He just said, you know, I should have got it out of the way faster. I didn't do it, you know, Tony beat me.
Wow, that's crazy.
You know, my fault. But, yeah, he lost an extra 5 seconds because of it. And without that, Dempsey probably would have remained the champ.
Right. Wow.
So
the precedent set as far as there being debate or maybe debate. Like the precedent was definitely set. Maybe that's where John King felt confidence coming from. The precedent was set that technicality was something that, you know, had been issued in the past as far as determining a winner versus a loser. But
so you look at the Tyson countdown, you say, okay, it's definitely quicker, right? Do you have any issue with the eighth round count as far as it being valid?
No, I don't. Okay. I think I would venture to guess, I'm no boxing expert by any means, but I'd venture to guess that the reason the ref count holds precedent over the timekeeper's count is because they're also there and able to determine the health of the person getting back off the mat.
When Tyson comes up,
the ref is hugging, like he's grabbing him and holding him, kind of stabilizing him and stuff. I think the eighth round time frame was like maybe possibly longer than the Tyson one. It was definitely more a matter of him collecting his wits and getting off the mat slower, which is my takeaway. So I think while if you were just going to have a stopwatch and determine it, I bet you the time for Douglas was in the eighth was a little bit longer than the one for Tyson in the tenth. But as far as the quality of the boxer returning to the fight, I don't think there's a debate.
Oh, no. Buster was ready for it.
Right. He was getting back up. Tyson, I'm not sure where he was, somewhere besides Tokyo at that moment.
So Buster spends the next – couple 8 months fighting for his right to be called heavyweight champion.
Right.
And from what I was watching too, he was flying, I think, from Vegas to LA to New York, trying to meet with different lawyers to figure out, because the WBC and the WBA would not give him the title for this fight. And it almost seems so the IBF gave it to him, but the IBF wasn't even credentialed for the fight. Like the president The president had to watch it on HBO in Jersey. So
nobody was there.
It almost seems like the IBF gave him the title just out of spite to, you know, they say that they believe Douglas, but almost seems like it might be out of spite to the WC and WBA for not inviting him to the, you know, to the dance kind of thing. Like, okay, fine. Well, you know,
we're going to name this other guy.
Exactly. Exactly. And the WBC and the WBA didn't give the title to Tyson. It wasn't like they were saying the title was Tyson's.
Right.
They were just withholding, withholding judgment at the time. But Buster said in interviews, they asked him, hey, would you be willing to go back into the in the arena with Tyson as a rematch if you're called anything other than the heavyweight champion? And Buster was like, nope, not at all. Not at all. If I go back in the arena, it's I'm the heavyweight champion. He would not, you know, not bow down to that at all. He felt like he earned it. I mean, he did earn it. He took an uppercut from Tyson and came back two rounds later to finish the guy off. That's championship material
he
right there.
He put in his work. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Well, I just felt like everybody in the aftermath too was scrambling because it wasn't expected. I think that if Tyson had gotten his wish, taken care of Douglas and gotten to fight Holyfield and it was reversed. I mean, I think it has to do with the fighters that were in it. If you, in a hypothetical scenario, exchange Douglas for Holyfield, I don't think there's this controversy. I don't think that there's this aftermath because that would have been seen as two people on equal levels. Holyfield just bested him, which he goes on to do twice for Tyson. But, you know, I think it's just this matter of this wasn't even, I mean, yeah, maybe it was out of spite, you know, the IBF did that, but like, it's almost like no, everybody was just waiting for the paper the next day to see how badly Tyson beat him, you know, like nobody was really paying attention to this as having that sort of impact because nobody thought it was a close fight, going to be a close fight.
Yeah, and the Japanese program, I guess, with a synopsis, post-fight, one of the lines read, Rocky lives and his name is James Buster Douglas. So they saw that as just being a phenomenal, phenomenal upset. Like you said, like nobody expected that at all.
Here's your movie, Hollywood. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm surprised they even made a movie out of it.
Right.
So his claim to fame, he beats Tyson. And then his life just falls apart, which is interesting kind of how you have this upward trajectory where you hit the pinnacle, you hit that peak, and then your life collapses under you. So he was champion for 8 months. And in this time, he even mentions he was not ready for the Holyfield fight. He was
champion for about 45 minutes too. I mean, because then you wind up having all this controversy too, as far as the, and I apologize if anybody's listening to this, that we're two kids from the Midwest, we say controversy a little weird, but
controversy.
I just mean like the con, it's the Wisconsin.
The controversy.
The controversy, yes. But I mean, all that took away from it. So, like, of his own admission, he had a interesting, you know, series of interviews celebrating 30 years this past. Earlier this year, and Douglas is honest as far as saying, like, listen, I was given so little time to enjoy this, not to mention 8 months later then having to throw the gloves on against Holyfield.
And Holyfield, man, what a absolute beast. You could talk about him all day too. Just an absolute
He had his own dominance, absolutely.
Yeah. So he lost Douglas lost to Holyfield in like three rounds. It was like a 90-second fight or something? I forgot. It was something just real quick. Holyfield just took him out. And then Buster just went downhill. Like he put on weight, I think it said up to 400 pounds. He was in a diabetic coma, almost lost his life. So just interesting how the Tyson fight, he won, but at what cost? You know? What was the cost of beating him? What was the cost of being called the heavyweight champion of the world? What was, you know, Douglas, in my opinion, gave up his life to beat Tyson. It was everything to him. He gave up everything to beat Tyson, to be the heavyweight champion of the world. Like what a, yeah.
Yeah. and dedicated so much time to it and so much energy, and then to get it, so much energy just to have a shot. Like, all he wanted was the shot, and that's why, like, hearkening back to the Tucker fight where he missed out on that opportunity to fight Tyson then, which he would have in 87. Mm-hmm. But now 3 years later, after different training, different trainers, like you said, going at it like a demon as far as his preparation for it. Here you arrive at the absolute top of the mountain experience, doing the thing. Even I would venture to guess under a lie detector sometime late 89, early 90, Douglas might not have thought that he could beat Tyson, but he knew he belonged there. He belonged in that ring with him, is what he felt. And so to have that, to have one of arguably the best putting it together for Douglas in a single fight, as far as, you know, some of the things about him earlier years where, you know, he didn't, like you said, he just didn't have all the pieces fit together, and they all fit together that one night in Tokyo, and to have this triumph, and then immediately sullied by people calling it into question. And then, while people are, he's having to deal with that emotionally and mentally, and then 8 months later, he becomes a non-factor after the knockout against Holyfield.
So two final questions before we go and like maybe get some lessons learned about kind of, you know, taking this and applying to life kind of thing. So if Buster beats Tucker in 87,
yep,
does he beat Tyson in 87?
I don't think he does.
I don't think he does. I don't think he does because he didn't have the strategy.
Yeah.
He didn't have the strategy for it. He did not have the strategy for it. Tyson was still – he was well-known, but he wasn't as established in 87 as he was now. And then is the loss to Holyfield, does that kind of give credibility to the controversy? Like, does that – does his quick loss to Holyfield kind of seem like, okay, yeah, Tyson did knock you out in the eighth round? You know, you just got lucky.
Right. I don't know, because again, it's weird. We say that history is written by the victors, but the post 1990 Tyson Douglas fight has kind of been written by Tyson or other circumstances. Like, one of the biggest takeaways for me as far as life lessons learned is this man spent all this time building up this ability. He comes through in a remarkable, almost miraculous way. But the story written after the fact is Tyson and Holyfield. It's all these other players. Like, it's almost like, I don't think this fight is remembered properly, as you mentioned, as being one of the greatest upsets in sports history. But it almost to me feels like no one won or lost, because Tyson doesn't really lose. As far as it doesn't destroy him, it might send him down a trajectory emotionally or out of the ring, to some other stuff and demons that he's talked about for his own life. But as far as his actual ability as a boxer, it doesn't destroy or stop anything. It's almost like a blip on the radar for Tyson as he then goes on to have these huge bouts with Holyfield and other people.
So you mentioned that kind of the lesson learned there. Curious too, what other kind of lessons you learned? I think sports is a great thing for life, you know, great analogy for life. So what kind of life lessons did you learn? Like, what kind of takeaways are you taking this from your life as you kind of, you know, try to, you know, stay on course and try to, you know, become better people? And
I would say one of the biggest, the obvious one is to not take things lightly. I mean, as far as like the Tyson side of stuff, you know, to view your achievements as things that need to last, as things that need to be worked at and continually worked at, versus, you know, all I think the life lesson of like peeking ahead to the next big thing is something I fail to do quite often. I don't think there's any denying as far as Tyson looking ahead to Holyfield, you know, being a factor in this.
Or even the same way too, Buster in the eighth round thinking, hey, I got you. I got you now. Like, look at me now. I'm going to beat your ass, like you said, right? And taking your eye off the fight. You know, it's oftentimes what takes us out in life isn't what we're fighting, what we see in front of us, is what we take our eye off of. Right. It's those blindside things.
Right.
And I had a conversation with a guy yesterday. Asked me like, "Hey, what kind of areas in life do concern you the most?" And I was like, "Dude, it's the one that I don't know about yet. That's right. What keeps me up at night. Because like the ones I know about, I'm fighting, right? And I feel like if I'm fighting it, I at least got a chance. If I go down fighting, I can go down fighting.
Right.
That's not the ones. It's the things in my life that I don't know I struggle with. It's the things in my life that I don't realize are taking me out. Because those are the demons that are going to, you know, those are the ones that will jump you in the alley in the back in the night in the back. And like, you don't see it coming at all.
Yeah, the surprises. So, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Just hypothetically speaking, like a year where there's a pandemic and a bunch of uprising, you know, and
it's like a Jumanji movie.
Someone said it's
like what did the Rock do to us?
Right, but you're right. Like nobody prepared for this year. Nobody prepared for the events that were going to come. This was the unexpected outcome. This was an unexpected obstacle, to say the least. That you know. That we as a country or a world or individually as people we face. I think one thing I do take away from, you know, positively from Douglas, this guy is still celebrating this thing 30 years later. And I love that. Like he earned it. He deserved it. I think there is an aspect of like when we reach our high, we have to watch for that valley to hit right after it as far as,
it hit for him.
And it hit for him right away. Or just people that want to come against, you know, achievements you might have. But one thing I'm a big proponent of or reinforcer of for my own self is to celebrate wins. I think we go through we go through a lot of mundane things in life and we might be like, oh sweet, that worked out or something. But just his ability 30 years later to celebrate that. I think there might be things, you know, as he looks back that he might do different, you know, or as he reviews his life. But one of the huge factors for Douglas, even today, 30 years later, is the fact that he beat Mike Tyson that one night. And there's an element that I learned from that for my own life, to take time to really celebrate those wins, those unbelievable achievements that come across.
Celebrate those wins. And if you want to, you know, if you want to foster a relationship with people who are close to you, mean a lot to you, celebrate their wins, you know, like let them know, like celebrate their wins. Like if you, like if I read this, this clinical psychologist from Canada, Jordan Peterson, said, if you want to destroy somebody, wait until they do something good to you and then ignore them. Or just, you know, do something good and then ignore them. Like no response, right? Just take, it could take the wind out of their sails or wait, do something really good, then respond negatively kind of thing. But the opposite works too. If you respond positively, if you celebrate their accomplishments and their wins, that's huge. Like that builds them up so much. That like positive feedback is such an underrated thing, especially for the seemingly small victories, right? It's Douglas didn't get to the point of being able to fight Tyson without winning those small victories along the way, right? You don't get to that point without winning those small victories and celebrate those, you know. Celebrate those kind of things. Even celebrate the losses too. Celebrate the Tucker losses, where you realize like every time you go into the ring, every time you go to battle, you have a chance to prove yourself. I remember when I was kind of fighting some kind of internal battles at work. A guy told me, he's like, never back down from a fight. He said, even if you lose, you have a chance to kind of sharpen your skills, no matter what. And that's valuable. So like even the losses.
Oh, that reset it. Absolutely.
Yeah. He's like, think of it as practice. If you lose, you would have lost if you didn't fight. At least this way, you can kind of sharpen your skills. You know what works, what doesn't work, and kind of, you know, kind of see what works.
Yeah.
So the lesson I learned from it was the comparison with being the champ versus being called the champ, right? It seemed like Buster really wanted to be called the champ. He viewed himself as the champ, but he wanted that title, right?
Yep.
He wanted that title.
He wanted that moment.
He wanted the moment. And it reminded me of what we trained in the Army of be no do. And that was kind of the process of it too, was First, you be. You be who you're supposed to be. And then you know what you're supposed to, what that is. And then finally you do it. You act it out. And it's in that order. And it's kind of, you know, almost seems counterintuitive that, okay, I need to know it first. And then I have to do it. And if I do it, I can be it. But right. that's not the way life works.
Not the way it goes.
You have to be it first. You have to be it. And then once you are that, then you can know it, and then you can do it. And it comes from the heart without too, which is, And then the final thing I learned, the final thing too, was that a one-eyed Tyson lacking discipline still almost beat Douglas. Which is to say, you can train your hardest, you can train your heart out, but sometimes shit happens, and you gotta realize that you don't always get that extra, you know, the extra seconds that Don King thinks you got. But if you get it, take advantage of it. You know, take it. You
know. Right, use them.
If you're gonna put up a couple extra seconds in the clock because of a fake holding penalty on Aaron Rodgers in the Detroit game, why not throw the Hail Mary every time?
Yeah. That's right. Go ahead and let those lungs fill with breath before you blow that whistle. Let's just take your time.
Take your time. Yeah.
I think my biggest takeaway too from it was just kudos to Douglas. Kudos to James Buster Douglas as far as making the most of an opportunity, training his ass off for it. Once having that opportunity, not letting up from the plan. Like, there's just so much to learn from it. But one of the biggest takeaways for me is just kudos to that guy. I feel like, I don't know if he gets enough, like, this is known as one of the biggest upsets ever, and I still don't think he gets enough credit for it. I think
it's viewed as Tyson loss versus the Douglas win.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And Tyson's been in our mindset ever since, and Douglas has this one note. It's almost to me like the some of the other things you still think about. I think of like the 72 Dolphins, right? Like anybody that loves football knows about the 72 Dolphins. We don't know about the 71 Dolphins. We don't know about the 73 Dolphins. We know about the 72 because of what they did. And we know about Buster Douglas because of what he did that night in Tokyo, that no one saw coming, that no one thought possible. And sometimes when you get a chance, you can defeat the odds.
Yeah, 42-1. Yeah. I think the biggest lesson learned too is throw a couple bucks on a 42-1 odds.
Absolutely. I'm here for all the sports betting analogies and takeaways.
Just go ahead
for sure.
Go ahead and throw, and you know, I don't know if the individuals who won that wrote thank you letter to the Mirage for that bet, but man, like
yeah, I don't know if people write thank you letters to casinos. Usually, ledger line's still in favor of casinos.
Hey, I still hold a positive ledger line in there my you gambling go. Record. There you go. There so you go. I think I'm plus like 10 bucks right now. So that's
there you
that's,
go.
Yeah,
there you go. I was once plus. I do keep a record of them all, but man,
I'm only plus because we walked out. We were on our last night in Vegas. My wife and I walked out. I threw a couple quarters in the old casino thing and the slot machines. And I won like 15 bucks right there. Like, there we go.
Right. See, that's like from a movie or something. You don't know how much.
Last second thing. Yeah.
You don't know how much change I've lost by pretending I was walking out and throwing them in a slot.
Exactly. I was actually
like,
walking.
Oh, this is the time.
I think that's the key. Is like it knows because I was literally walking out at the time. Yeah.
No, I've tried to fool the gambling gods.
Doesn't work.
All right, we'll catch you. Pleasure, man. Hopefully keep them going and kind of uncovering some of these gems and some of the notes that surround some of our favorite sporting events.
Like I think it'd be good as we unpack these things and kind of look at the kind of peeling back the onion, see what's behind those layers and learning more and more about them.
Yeah, I had a blast. It was fascinating.
So I love it. All right,
talk to you
man. All right, see you safe.
Thank you for joining us here on Further Review. For our next episode, we'll be tackling one of college football's biggest upsets.
And I'll tell the story of how I told the starting cornerback for the Kansas City Chiefs that he'd never make it in the NFL. True story.
Oh, that's phenomenal. Can't wait. That's what we have coming up for you on the next episode of On Further Review. Please rate, review, subscribe. We can be found on most preferred platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or you can visit us at anchor.fm/further-review. That's anchor.fm/further-review. We'd love to hear from you and hope you enjoyed listening as much as we enjoyed bringing this to you.
Hey, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and share it with someone. If you didn't enjoy it, let someone know. Either way, smash that share button.